Thank you, Will. Thank you all for having me here. I should just start with a disclaimer that, and this I say before every talk, my last name is Doctor. I'm not a PhD yet. So, you know, when I contact people out of the blue, they think I'm a professor or something. But no, I'm just a lowly grad student. And this is actually my first time giving a long seminar on my research. So thank you all for being guinea pigs for this. And you know, if you have questions or anything, just let me know as they come up. That'll be the easiest way to deal with any confusion. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you about some work that I've done with Ben Farr and Dan Holtz. Both of them are at UChicago with me. Dan is my advisor. And then we've also worked with Michael Puer at AEI in Germany. And we have a paper that's hopefully gonna be on archive very soon. And this paper is called Statistical Gravitational Waveform Models, What to Simulate Next. So let me just parse this title for you because it has two parts that are seemingly disjoint. In the first part, we're going to suggest a way to model what a gravitational wave signal looks like statistically. So rather than having a model that says, here's what the strain of a gravitational wave looks like as a function of time, we might say, here's the distribution of possible strains as a function of time. And this actually will lead us to be able to inform the numerical relativity groups where they should run their simulations in order to make our statistical model better. So sort of broadly speaking, this fits into this category of machine learning because what we're doing is we're learning from data from specifically numerical relativity waveforms. So we're gonna use that as data and we're gonna learn from it, and then we're also gonna try to make educated guesses about what to learn next. So this is just like what we do. We know what things we're uncertain about when we research something, and so we know what to go look up based on that. And that's sort of what our model is gonna do. It knows where it's uncertain, and it will try to learn things at places that are it doesn't know a waveform very well. So I'm gonna go into this and tell you all about it. All right, so let's just start off with what we all already know. Black holes merge. They merge within a Hubble time. We know this. We know that they have they're parameterized by masses and spins. So that's really 8 parameters that quantify or characterize one of these sources. That assumes that the binary of black holes is circularized and some other assumptions, but roughly speaking, there's really 8 parameters that we're usually interested in LIGO to characterize the source itself. There are, of course, other parameters that we estimate, like the distance to the binary, the inclination of the binary, all of these other sort of extrinsic parameters. But intrinsic to the source are really these 8 that we're interested in. So when one of these mergers occurs, we get some gravitational waves that travel to us, and we pick those gravitational waves up in our detector and measure a strain, h of t, and also some noise. Some noise on there. So what you get is some waveform. So this is time, strain. This is actually GW150914. And so if you remember from last year, we were able to use this signal to infer back what the masses and spins of the black holes were that led to the signal in the first place. And so this game is called parameter estimation. And what you'd like to do is to infer these parameters from this. You're going to need some sort of model that will tell you how to go from parameters to some strain of as a function of time. And that model, of course, is general relativity. It's worth mentioning that one of the issues with this sort of schematic is that general relativity is not going to be easily solved by us for these more complex spacetimes in a sort of reasonable amount of time. And what I mean by reasonable amount of time is milliseconds or seconds. So what we do instead is we've created these families of approximants. These are just approximate models of general relativity. They work in various ways. That different approximants do different things in different ways. But they're all sort of in some way, they're tuned to general relativity. So let me just explain to you a little bit about how the parameter estimation works so you get a feel for why we're interested in waveforms. Here's the quantity on the left. This is what we ultimately want in parameter estimation. We want, what's the probability of some source parameters? So this is like masses, spins. What's the probability of the source parameters given the data that we have? And to do that, what you need to do is evaluate this thing, the likelihood function, the probability of the data given the source parameters. And so to evaluate this thing, you need to be able to produce a waveform for any lambda that I give, any set of parameters, you want to be able to produce the waveform for that with your model. And since our the space of parameters for these models are, you know, 8-dimensional or 15-dimensional if you take into account the sky position and distance, et cetera, you clearly, this is a huge space that you need to be able to predict these over. And if you want to do numerical relativity to figure out what those signals look like for each parameter, you're going to be spending, you know, maybe another Hubble time just trying to get all of those simulations done. So that's why we use the approximants, because they're much faster to be able to predict the signal and then calculate this. That's why we use them. Of course, these approximants are going to create some challenges for us. The first one is what I said before. The different approximants work in different ways. They're applicable over different domains. They have different speeds at which they're evaluated. So all of these things make it so that you have to make a choice about what approximant you want to use. And even once you've made that choice, the approximant could still have systematic errors that will bias your PE results, which is bad. I don't know if any of you remember, but some of the papers that were put out last year with the first discovery, there were actually three sets or multiple sets of numbers that were quoted for the parameter estimates. And that's because there were multiple waveform families or different approximants that were used. And each of those gave a different, you know, a slightly different probability distribution. So this is a little bit of a problem. So what you want to do ultimately is incorporate numerical relativity in some ways. But as I've mentioned, you can't just brute force a bunch of numerical relativity simulations and then use those to do your parameter estimation. It just takes them too long to be run. It'll take weeks to months to run one of these numerical relativity simulations with the resources that groups tend to have right now. So here's one idea that's been put out there. What if you just took these numerical relativity simulations that exist and you just interpolated between them? It's a pretty simple idea, but it immediately raises two questions. The first question is, what's the error level of the surrogate model? And by surrogate, I just mean the interpolation. How good are the interpolations? And secondly, if we're going to interpolate between numerical relativity simulations, we want those numerical relativity simulations to have placements in parameter space that allow us to make good interpolations. We don't want all of the numerical relativity simulations to have the same spin. Otherwise, we won't know anything about, you know, other spins. So these are just two complications that come in immediately if you want to use a scheme like interpolation of previous simulations. So let me just show you a picture. Just in case you're still confused about what I mean by interpolate, I mean, just here's one simulation at some parameters, here's some simulation at other parameters, and I'm just going to use some scheme to interpolate the waveform at some other known parameters that I want to know. Okay, so our proposal is to, rather than actually interpolate between the waveforms, we want to do a statistical interpolation with this process called Gaussian process regression. So instead of saying, here's this function value exactly given all the other function values, we're going to say, what's the probability of a certain function value given all the other known function values? So we're going into a much more probabilistic regime. Why do we want to do this? Firstly, the waveforms that we get will come with uncertainties, which means that they're less likely to bias any of the parameter estimates that we make. We can take those uncertainties into account in the parameter estimation. So if the waveform is slightly off, it will not bias things as much. Additionally, these waveforms from Gaussian process regression will be much faster to evaluate than numerical relativity. So I'm talking This will work on the order of milliseconds or seconds rather than weeks. And then the last reason that this is nice is that you can make this this regression scheme work pretty well by using the errors on the waveforms to strategically put new numerical relativity waveforms down that will then be sort of maximally informative to your model. And I use maximally informative. I don't mean that in a strict sense. I mean that in a hand-wavy sense. Okay, that's the proposal. So what this will give us instead is it's the same picture I showed before, but now when we interpolate, we're going to get something with uncertainty bars on it. Okay, before I start this, does anybody have any questions about what I've said so far? Okay, just stop me if anything's not making sense. So the basic idea behind Gaussian process regression is that we're going to model functions as distributions rather than just a specific f of x. It'll be more of a probability distribution on f of x. The basic idea is that if I have some point here, f, and I have another point here, f star of a function, or let's say f prime, I can describe the probability distribution of these two function values. And in particular, I can use a joint Gaussian distribution. That's the assumption behind a Gaussian process, that if I have two function values, they're completely specified by their means and some sort of covariance matrix between the two points. So everything is just described by a high-dimensional Gaussian distribution. So usually this is chosen such that points that are close together, so if x and x prime are very close together on the function, they will covary, the function values there will covary strongly. Things that are far apart will not covary really at all. That's what you usually choose to be here. So you can kind of see how that will impose that points that are nearby to each other will have similar function values, and if points that are far apart are not really, don't really talk to each other, so to speak. So here's a pictorial representation just to give you a sense. So in this left panel, what's shown is some prior. So by prior, what I mean is you can write down this Gaussian process distribution with just some mean and covariance. And what's done here is that the mean is assumed to be zero. That's why it's centered here. And the covariance function, when you marginalize onto just this x-axis, what you get is these error bars. And since this is a high-dimensional Gaussian distribution, I can just pull actual samples from it. And these curves right here show example samples from that distribution. So let me sketch this out a little bit more. I mean, here, let's say on this x-axis, there's 1,000 points that I want to know the function at. I can write down those covariance matrices that I showed, the covariance, and use this covariance function here to write down a covariance matrix for these 1,000 points. And that covariance matrix will define an n-dimensional Gaussian that I can, or a 1,000-dimensional Gaussian, I guess, that I can then pull a sample from. And that sample will just be a vector that turns out to be one of these samples. And then I can actually measure my function at a few points. So let's suppose I measure the function value at these few points. I can then condition my model on my known f's to get a prediction of what f is at other points in the parameter space. And again, I can still pull the samples from the distribution, so it's all still statistical. Does anybody have any questions at this point? Yeah.
Do you only use Gaussian distributions or also?
Everything, so yes, here everything is assumed to be Gaussian. The probability distributions are all Gaussian. That's what makes this a tractable method.
So if, for example, in the limit you have an infinite sample of points and it matches up with more of those curves, does the probability of the one that step in? Like it's the equivalent to the standard deviation going to
Sorry, does the probability of what go to 1?
So if your input is for these particular parameters, you get this curve. And then as you get more and more samples, so the probability that it is actually lose that one input you gave it go to 1? Or is there always sort of difference between 1?
So, in theory, I could make it so that these points are exact numbers, and so then if I infinitely sample this, then yeah, it should converge to what the truth is. So it should, fully, if I've sampled the function completely, then I should know exactly what it is, but you can actually have some uncertainties on these values as well. And so then, as you add more points, you'll still have some sort of uncertainty bar. It just depends on how you set up the problem. But
is that? Later, you're gonna make a model like the sigma plus the noise.
Yes. So actually, we're not going to model the noise here. This is only modeling the signal. The noise will happen later. So this doesn't take anything into account about the noise. It's just saying, what's the uncertainty on the model itself, given what I know about the model at other points in parameter space? Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe it'll become clearer as I go forward, but you can just ask me again. Okay, so to actually compute this, which you could probably write yourself in like an afternoon, maybe. You want to do regression. You have some points f of a function. You've already measured them. These are what we'll call training points. And then you have some point f star or points f star, and you want to know the function there, or at least get a distribution of the function values there. Those are called the test points. And like I said before, all of these points must follow a joint Gaussian distribution. So I can immediately, just from writing this down, I can immediately write that it's described by this normal distribution. What I've done here is I've just made the mean of this distribution 0. It could be anything, but in practice, people will find ways to regularize their functions or massage them in such a way that the mean they can assume that the mean is 0, the prior mean is 0. And then you have this covariance matrix, and again, you can fill this out, the elements of this matrix out, with this function. You just evaluate the function at the two points, and that'll give you the covariance between them, and that will allow you to fill in the elements of this matrix. And one thing you'll notice is that I've taken this matrix and I've broken it into 4 submatrices. And so this matrix just describes the covariances of the training points. This gives us the covariances of the test points, and these are the sort of cross covariances. And from here, you can just do some matrix algebra to ask the question, what's the probability of getting a value f star given that I know all these other f's? Okay, very probabilistic question. And indeed, just with matrix algebra, you can find that this will give you a mean function that looks like this, and a covariance function that looks like this. It's a little bit grosser, but let me just quickly unpack this for you. This you can kind of think of as that kernel function, and we're going to put one of those kernel functions at each training point, and it'll be weighted by whatever this turns out to be. So it's essentially just a sum of whatever your kernel function is up here, this guy. It's just going to be a sum of those with weights. That'll give you your mean function. And then the covariance, let's just ignore the second half here. This first thing, this is just what we wrote down was the prior covariance on the test points. This is just immediately what you would say from the prior is the covariance. But then as the elements of these matrices grow, which means that the test points and the training points are closer together, this will start to get larger and cancel this out, meaning that you're going to get smaller uncertainties on your function as you go closer to a training point. That's sort of intuitive. And you can see that in this picture right here, again. As you go close to a training point, your uncertainties go down. But as you go far away from the training points, you're going back to what the prior was from here. OK, are there any questions so far? Sorry, that was a little technical.
Can you just go into a little bit more detail about how these kernel functions and covariance functions are derived? Like, suppose I have my function with a set of test points. How do I get the covariance set?
I'm going to tell you about that. But technically, the covariance function, you can choose pretty much anything you want, so long that as it gives you covariance matrices that are positive semi-definite. But I'm going to tell you how we choose the covariance function. And that's the learning part of this. But in practice, some people might say, I already know what my covariance function looks like. Most people will just use like a Gaussian. It's essentially like they're essentially smoothing the data in some way. And they'll just choose the parameters of that Gaussian based on what they think will match their data. But we're going to actually learn our covariance function from the data first before doing the regression. And I'm gonna tell you about that. So for now, just take the covariance function as this random function that you choose, and it will look something like a Gaussian. OK, before I go any further, I just want to give a disclaimer. What I've said I want to do is take numerical relativity simulations, use those to build a Gaussian process regression model, and then use the Gaussian process regression model in the parameter estimation. Everything I'm going to present to you here is based not on numerical relativity simulations, but instead on this approximant family called IMR phenom D. So the reason I'm using IMR phenom D rather than numerical relativity is because IMR phenom D is very quick to evaluate, and I can evaluate it at continuous values of the mass ratio or the masses or what have you. So I'm just going to use IMR phenom D here to use a subset of IMR phenom D waveforms to train the Gaussian process model. And then once I have the Gaussian process model, I can go to a random point in parameter space and ask for both the Gaussian process and IMR phenom D, and then I can compare them. So this is how I'm going to measure if our regression is good or bad. Okay, this is essentially cross-validation, if you've ever heard that term. But yeah, we're just using IMR phenom D because it's going to be easier right now as a proof of concept. But eventually, everything will use numerical relativity. That's the goal. So just to sketch it out, I have some IMR phenom D at a few parameter values that I start with. I use those to train my Gaussian process model. And then that will give me a waveform at whatever set of parameters I choose. And then I can also produce the IMR phenom D waveform with those parameters. And then I can compare them. And that's what I'm going to do throughout much of this talk, just to convince you that our model is working well. All right, so we want to actually implement this interpolation scheme. But remember what these waveforms are that we're trying to interpolate. I mean, they're these long time series. Let's suppose you're sampling at 44 kilohertz or something like that. So a second of data is going to be this 44,000 samples. So that's a lot of data. This is a sort of big data problem. And so we need to reduce these long time series to something that's more manageable. And that's sort of whole idea is called reduced order modeling. And so what we do is we're going to represent waveforms in a reduced order model. And we'll then do the regression on the reduced order model rather than on the actual waveforms. Because if I was to have 40,000 points for each waveform in my training set, you can imagine I'd have to do roughly 40,000 interpolations. But by reducing the order of the model, I have to do fewer interpolations. So the reduced order model that we use is from a paper by Michael Pure. And it's a singular value decomposition model, which operates in the frequency domain. So just to give you a sense, here's some example waveforms for binary black hole mergers in the frequency domain. So on the top, I'm showing you the amplitude function. On the bottom, I'm showing you the phase function. And so each of these curves is like a different set of parameters. Okay, this is different from the time frequency plots you probably saw in LIGO papers, which show that sort of chirp type of thing. This is just pretty much the Fourier transform, the FFT of the data. It's the easiest way to think about it, rather than a spectrogram. So these are sorts of things we want to interpolate here. And so what we'll do to make a reduced order model is once we've projected everything into the frequency domain, is rather than taking all the points on this, we'll just take a few points for each of these. Okay, so now we've reduced the dimension of each of these waveforms. And we're going to do one more thing before we try to do the regression. We're going to take each of these, you know, now just a smallish vector of amplitudes and phases. We're going to take those vectors and we'll project them into some other basis, an SVD basis. Essentially what this means is I'm taking the data and we're going to find some basis in which the data is maximally spread, meaning it's the sort of maximally informative. And it also will sort of decorrelate the entries. So for example, let me show you. So the amplitude here and the amplitude here should be correlated, and there's going to be correlations between each of these and each of these. So by taking the singular value decomposition, to some degree, we can decorrelate those different bins. And by doing that, we can sort of ignore any correlations between the things that we're interpolating. All right, just gonna. Okay. So I can go into this in more detail, but I think it'll just kind of get boring very quickly, so we can talk about it later. But here's pretty much the name of the game. I've got waveforms in my training set. And once I move them to the reduced order model, what they're going to look like now is this list of coefficients, some numbers. The first, you know, 50-ish will be amplitude coefficients. The other 50-ish will be phase coefficients. And so now I've taken this, you know, let's say 44,000 point thing and turned it into something that's roughly 100 points. And what you'll notice is that each of these coefficients that describes a waveform is a function of the input parameters. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take each of these functions, C1, C2, C3, I'm going to just interpolate them with Gaussian process regression. So each one of these I'll completely separately interpolate. And what I will get from that interpolation is a mean function and then Gaussian uncertainties. So once I've done the interpolation, I can then go, you know, sort of undo all the steps that I did to get here and go back to a waveform with uncertainty bars. All right. This is the sort of flow of how this is going to work. So just give you another second to look at it. Okay. Let me just skip this slide. Okay, so now let's just get to the covariance function with which Jonah was asking about. So like I said before, the most common kernel function or covariance function that's used is a Gaussian called the squared exponential for some reason in Gaussian process literature, but they use a Gaussian. We don't use a Gaussian for a few reasons that I can describe later if you're interested. But the thing to really take away is this function here, firstly, it falls away at large r, where r is the distance between two points in the input space. So the distance between two x's that are going to give us f of x's. So that's going to fall away as the distance between the points goes to infinity. And then you'll also see there's these two other sort of parameters in here, this L and sigma. You can kind of think as L as like a smoothing scale, like what's the scale on which this function will tend to turn over? And the sigma is going to tell you roughly what's the scale of excursions that this function tends to take away from the mean. So if you've ever done like smoothing of data or anything, you know that the kernel you use to smooth, you can change the parameters of it. The same thing goes here. You can change these parameters. However, there's a probabilistic way for us to choose which parameters we want to use here. This is the learning part. What we'll do is we'll twiddle these parameters. We'll mess with them, change them. And then every time we change them, we'll ask, given these parameters and this kernel function, how likely is the data that I already have? So here's actually a plot that shows this. For a bunch of different values of the covariance and the length scale, I can ask how probable is my data set that I have under that prior. And you can see there's this sort of nice distribution with a maximum. And that maximum is what we choose, that maximum sort of likelihood or posterior on these parameters is what we use to fill in the sigma and L here.
Are sigma and L chosen on a per point basis or global?
It's global. So I'll have some, let's go back to here. This picture is nice. Okay, so I've got my data points here, 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 here. And I'm gonna ask, just forget about everything except for these little crosses. I can ask the question, given some covariance function, how likely is it that I got these data points? So in that sense, it's global. Is that what you were asking? Yeah. So here, what they did in this example is they just chose whatever sigma and L that they wanted. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask which sigma and L are going to maximize the probability that I got these points specifically.
So if you're just looking at the points that you've already have the input data at, does that tell you that those are for the probability 1 except equal to R equals 0 in that expression?
Yeah, so it's the probability that I would have gotten those values under the prior. So I think if we go back to, let's see. Yeah, so this prior right here, I can use it to evaluate if I actually got some values for F. This is the prior distribution. This is before I've done any conditioning. So I can still ask, what's the probability that I got some F values that happen to be this, that, and the other? Yes. So that's if you condition on the known points. In this case, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to ask, how likely was it that I got the points that I did if the covariance function happened to look like this? So let me think of another example where you might do this. I mean, let's suppose that you have a model for what time I show up to work, okay? And that model has a parameter in it. Now, you could have seen all the other times that I came into work over the last week. You know what those are, but you want to train a model and make a prediction for tomorrow what time I'm going to come to work. So the parameter in your model, you want to choose that such that it maximizes the probability that I would have come at all the times you saw last week. So I'm just going to, it's essentially just fitting the model to the existing data.
But so the model you're building does not necessarily exactly recover the points that you put into it?
It will recover the points exactly. Well, roughly exactly, depending on the details of the problem. But you will get back the data points. It's just asking how likely those were. So another example is like a linear regression.
It depends on the number of parameters you have.
By parameters, you mean parameters in the kernel?
If you have 5 clients and 2 parameters, then you can't match it exactly. But if you have 100 parameters in your model and 5 clients, then you can match them, right?
Sorry, are you talking about the parameters of the kernel or the parameter, the input parameter space, like the masses and spins of
the parameters you were optimizing?
Oh, right, right. So if you don't have enough, I mean, you can still optimize them even with a few points. It just won't be that informative on what those parameter values should be. So let me just give you an example that I think will make it clear. I mean, let's say I have I'm just doing some experiments, some X and Y, and I've measured points. I've already measured these. But I want to fit a linear model to that.
Can you turn on the whiteboard light? It's under the clock.
Is it?
It's lecture.
Lecture.
There we go.
Okay, so I could choose any line I want to fit through these. But we know that the line that we're going to choose, usually for linear regression, is the one that minimizes the sum of squares or whatever. So that's how we choose what parameters we'll use for y equals mx plus b. And then if I want to know the value of the function over here, then I can use this y equals mx plus b that I've tuned to the existing data.
But so in that example, because you're using a line, if I ask you what's the value of that particular point you already sampled, you'll give me something different than that completed point.
That's true. In the Gaussian process case, that will not be the case. You'll actually go through all of the points. It's just all that you're tuning is how much neighboring points co-vary. So if my function looks like this, and let's say I just change the length scale, I keep the covariance the same. Let's assume that each of these points is exact. Then if I change the covariance scale, what I'll get is these are my uncertainty bars. And then I can choose a different value for sigma, and that might make these error bars larger or smaller.
Yes, I guess the part I'm confused about is when you said that you're using the points that you also have the data points for, and then maximizing likelihood over those. Is it like you use all the points except a given one, and then you see what is the probability you said minus 1 points, and then you look at what the probability of the endpoint is, you do that for all of them or something like that?
No, it's almost exactly analogous to this case. I'm just going to pick the Gaussian process model that most likely reproduces the data I already have.
You essentially have two models that you're saying, right? You have one where you have 2 parameters, sigma and L, which you tune, and that looks like the linear regression case. And then you use a Bayesian inference to reshape that model with known measurements.
Yes, that's right.
So it's given to place in the
So I'm going to use...
So the former one is tuned, and then the latter one is prior.
So yeah, I think maybe there's some confusion because I've talked about a few different likelihoods and models, but there's this sort of hyper model, which is just what the covariance function is. And I can choose anything I want for that, but I'm just going to choose it such that it's most likely to reproduce things that look like my existing data, which is sort of the name of the game in machine learning. From the data that I have, I'm just going to try to choose a model that best fits that existing data and then use that to make projections for the future. So I can still get back the training points that I put in, depending on what the model is. In the linear case, I don't get back the same points that I put in, but in the Gaussian process case, you do, just because of the way that it actually is all sort of formulated. It really just has to do with the covariances of neighboring points. It's not like this case. So it will still allow you to go through all of your training points. Maybe we should talk about this more afterwards. But that was a really good question, because I think it's a little confusing. So, okay, so this is where all the learning is happening. This is where we're trying to train the model from the existing data. And that, and the training is by, you know, searching through the space and looking for which sigma and L are most likely to reproduce things that look like my data.
So, I mean, those numbers look pretty bad, right? Like 10 to the minus 20 is the best you can do. So is that saying like your covariance function is maybe it doesn't have enough parameters, or maybe it's not like an ideal functional form?
This is a likelihood density. So it's not really, like, the absolute scale of that is not meaningful here.
Okay.
It's just the comparison between values that matters. Okay. All right, so here's the part where we actually get to the regression. This is one of those coefficient functions I showed you before, just right here. Remember, I said I was going to try to interpolate a bunch of the, like 100 of these different coefficient functions. Here's one of them. And in red is what IMR phenom D gives for that one coefficient as a function of the mass ratio of the binary. So in this case, all I changed was the mass ratio. I kept everything else constant. And I just changed the mass ratio. And this red line is what IMR phenom D gives. And then the black dashed line is what the Gaussian process regression mean looks like. And you'll see they're pretty much right on top of each other. And so what I've done is I've just, in this bottom panel in red, I've plotted the fractional residual between the mean and IMR phenom D. So this is just essentially, this red is the error on the Gaussian process compared to the IMR phenom D. And one thing you'll notice is that there's these sort of bumps. Does anybody know why there's the bumps? So there's a bump, there's a trough at every single point that I have a training point. So these are all the points that I trained the Gaussian process with IMR phenom D. And then in between, I tried to find out what the Gaussian process would give. So I,
why doesn't it match on the training points?
Good question. Okay, so why does this not go down to like negative and go down to zero?
What, isn't it just a blotting out effect?
Is it a what effect?
Blotting out effect?
No, it's actually because there is, in the covariance function, what we and pretty much everyone else does is add a small variance to every single training point. The reason that you do this, one of the reasons, there's multiple, but one of the reasons you do this is because this thing, when you calculate this numerically, if you don't have some variance on your training points, then this can become negative. You can get negative variances. Just because computationally, not theoretically, but computationally, you'll end up with things that are giving you negative variances. And you can kind of guess that you would get something like that in this case. I mean, if these are, you know, perfect points, you'll, you know, just due to computational floating point errors and things, as you get close to here, it's possible to get negative variances. So we'll always add a little bit of a wiggle room on each of the training points. And this isn't actually a bad choice given the actual problem, because the numerical relativity simulations, they're not exactly perfect. They have varying resolutions. Some of the different methods that are used agree mostly, but not exactly. So we can also take into account a little bit of error on those simulations as well. So that's why these residuals don't go exactly to zero, because we've given a little bit of wiggle room on each training point. You don't have to go exactly through it.
What exactly is being plotted in the bottom panel?
So this red is the residual between the mean from the Gaussian process and IMR phenom D. Just the residual, but I think I've made it the fractional residual. So the errors here are, you know, 10 to the minus 3 times the actual amplitude of this function.
And what's in the black?
And then, okay, yeah, so let me get to the black.
Oh.
So the black is the 1 sigma uncertainties from the Gaussian process. So one of the things that you see is that the Gaussian process knows that away from the training points, your uncertainties are higher. And it also gives a not terrible estimate of what the maximum error level is across the space. So it obviously doesn't know exactly what the error level was. If it did, then we would already know general relativity. But it does give us some indication of where the errors are bad. And actually, you can't really tell that well here, but the uncertainties on the edges here are higher than in the center. And so what the Gaussian process is doing is it's going to tell us a little bit about what we think the uncertainty level is and where it might be higher than other places.
So here it seems like it's off by like 3 or 5 orders of magnitude in the middle.
Yeah. So what the Gaussian process, roughly speaking, will try to do is remember that the variances actually don't matter or don't depend at all on any of these function values. The only thing the variances depend on is the distance between neighboring training points. And so it's not surprising that all of these variances here are essentially the same, because they only depend on the distance between the training points. It knows nothing about any of this. And since all of these training points are the same distance, they're pretty much all going to look the same. Really what we're interested in is more if this error can give us a good estimate of what the max error is across the space. Because eventually what we want to do is just keep putting down simulations until we think that the error has gone below a certain level. And that's what this is going to allow us to do. Conceivably, what'll happen is you'll think that there's more error here in the center than there actually is. But that's just, you're never going to really know.
The wiggles like, aren't actually that strong because that constant term added to the variance is sort of comparable to the
Yeah, so I think in this case, certainly, you're getting closer to just what the intrinsic variance is of the training points. So it's doing quite well here. It's just getting close to what the variance of the training points is.
No, I meant sort of, if you didn't add that constant term to the variance, then the variance should go to zero.
Oh, yeah. This will just go. This will just go sharply to zero, yeah.
Yeah, but the fact that it's not going to zero, does that mean that constant term is sort of comparable to the intrinsic variance?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. And that constant term, I can fiddle with it. I've just chosen one number for it, but you can certainly fiddle with these things. Okay, so does everybody kind of understand what I did here? I just want to see what the time is. All right, we're totally running out of time, so I'm just going to zoom through some more things, and then we can. Okay, so I told you that we could make waveforms with uncertainties. Indeed, we can. I showed you amplitude and phase functions before, so kind of know what these look like. And here's some examples. Here's what IMR phenon D is in red. In blue is the Gaussian process mean, and in gray is the error bars, the 3 sigma error bars on the Gaussian process. In this one, you can't see the error bars because they're so small. And then in the bottom here, I've again shown the fractional residuals as a function of frequency. The red is the residual of the between this and this. And then this blue is just the 1 sigma errors from the Gaussian process. So as promised, I can give you waveforms with uncertainties just built off of existing numerical relativity simulations. Okay, so I'm just going to quickly say that there's a function we use called the mismatch to measure the errors. It measures, what we'll do with it is we'll just use it to see how similar is the Gaussian process mean to IMR phenom D. And this number will be zero mismatch. It'll be zero when they're exactly the same. There's no mismatch. The Gaussian process mean gives back exactly what the IMR phenom D had predicted. And then if the mismatch is one, that means that you have a lot of error. Your Gaussian process mean looks nothing like what the truth is. Okay, so this is just our sort of error function. So then what I can do is I can take all those interpolated coefficients that I showed you before. There's 100 of them. I can stack them back together and then propagate them back to the frequency domain, calculate that mismatch function. And so essentially what this plot is showing you is the error in our waveform model as a function of the mass ratio. And again, it falls lower at each of these training points. Okay. We can do this in two dimensions as well. So here this is the same coefficient function I showed you before, but now in two dimensions. Remember, there's like 100 of these. And so I'm varying the mass ratio and now the spin, where the spin is assumed to be equal for both the black holes and aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And again, you can get uncertainties. I plotted the residual here. This is pretty much the same thing I showed you before, but in 2D. And those black circles are the training points. So what, you know, as an analog to that mismatch plot I showed you before, it's the same thing, but now I'm plotting it as a function of both the mass ratio and the equal and aligned spin. And then the colors here represent the mismatch between the Gaussian process and IMR phenom D.
Are all the training points equally important?
Are each of the training points equally important?
Yes, you have these vertical lines. Does it mean that the resolution in the u and i direction should maybe be changed?
Yes, exactly, absolutely.
And so, I mean, you have a 2D grid. If you extend it to, 18-dimensional grid, you're kind of lost in the swamp.
Absolutely.
Could you reduce some of the points? Maybe just trace the boundary or something?
That's what I'm just about to tell you about.
Sorry.
Yes, but that I am glad that you brought that up because that's exactly where I want to go. I mean, you can see that this does pretty well on minimizing the mismatches. 10 to the minus 3 is the maximum here, and that's good enough for LIGO parameter estimation. But yeah, you'll notice that there's a lot of error here, not that much here. These points should be moved around, or some of them should be removed entirely. And I'll tell you how we're going to do that. So, to do that, what we're going to first do is have some way of estimating the error of our Gaussian process model straight from the Gaussian process with nothing else. What we've been doing so far is I've been showing you these mismatch plots that compare the Gaussian process to the quote-unquote truth. But in reality, you won't know what the truth is. You won't be able to compare back to the numerical relativity simulation because you won't have it yet. You have to generate it. You don't know it yet. So you need to estimate how bad is my Gaussian process model at this point in parameter space versus this point in parameter space. And we have some function which will estimate that error. I'm not going to go into how that works because we're running out of time. But we have some way of estimating the error from the Gaussian process uncertainties. And so then we can identify points in parameter space with the highest error in our model. And those are the points that we're going to suggest to put down a new numerical relativity simulation.
Okay, so one question. Is this a priori before you start any simulations? Or do you have some simulations and then you choose the next one?
So we actually already have some simulations, so that's how it will work. But what I've done, at least in the examples I'm going to show you, is I just seed this algorithm with a few waveforms that I put on the edge of the space. So I do start with putting some points on the edge.
So it's what you would call adaptive then. You have a solution,
right.
You look at the error, you get a better solution.
Yeah, it's just like a greedy algorithm, essentially, of putting down new simulations. We've come up with a sort of weird name for it, minimization of maximum estimated error placement. So we place the new training points to minimize the error in places where the maximum estimated error is highest. And so it's just easier to call this MEEP, which reminds me of Beaker, this Muppet, which I like. So this is just a pictorial version of that algorithm, right? We pick a few training waveforms, we build a Gaussian process reduced order model from it, we use that to calculate the estimated error across the space, we find which places have the highest estimated error, we put a new simulation there, run that simulation, add it back to our bank of existing simulations, and then just do this over and over again. Okay. And here is, let me just skip this and show you one example of this. So here I'm showing you the same number of training points as before, but you'll see that in this case, MEEP was able to put down the points in a fashion that kept the error much more flat over the space. So I'm just going to flash back and forth here between the regular grid I showed you before. You'll see that we're doing significantly better, and these are the same number of training points.
So my intuition would have been that the points should not pass the boundary. I can't really see that. Do you think that's the case here?
It'll depend on what kernel you use. But roughly speaking, the points will try to cluster a little bit to the boundary because the errors will be largest where there's fewer training points, and the boundaries have fewer training points nearby compared to the points in the center. So you'll slightly preferentially want to put points on the boundary, but slightly.
So it seems like the mismatch is larger on some of the training, right on the training points, than away from the training middle. You can't like make it give exactly the right answer on the training points.
So I can. So I can. There's a value. I can dial that down. I can make it so that there's less wiggle room on each training point. So sometimes you can get these numerical errors that come from trying to do that covariance calculation. You can also choose a different kernel. And so different kernels, if you choose that, then you are less likely to get these negative variances. But certainly in our case, I think this is reasonable because the wiggle room that I put on these is roughly what the wiggle room will be on actual numerical relativity simulations right now. So I think it's a reasonable thing. We know they're not going to be exact. So, but if you were to do this with a pen and paper, then yes, you could do it. You could do exact. Okay, and so now let me just show you a movie where I actually do this. Just to point out, I don't put down one point at a time. I actually put down 10 new training points at a time at the points with the highest. That's because there's people like you here that could run one simulation, and then I can ask my friend somewhere else to run another simulation. There you go, right. So I think doing one at a time would be a bad move. So I just choose the points with the 10 highest errors, and we put 10 down there. And you can see, even just in a few iterations, you're already pretty much below 10 to the minus 3. This is a fraction of the number of points that were shown before. So let me just show it one more time. Even after, let's say, about, 60-ish points, you've matched the error level from that regular grid, which had 120 points.
I think you could change the algorithm a bit and put more points at places where the error is higher. But right now you choose the locations, the 10 locations, and 8 out of these are already very good.
Yeah.
And it's just the lower left corner where you take more iterations. So if you were to put more points there, you would convert OD with faster.
So you mean let's say I find that this point here has a high error, put a bunch of training points in that area, you mean?
Yes.
I haven't tried that, but that may work. Of course, it depends on if I just put down one training point here and it's highly informative about the whole region, then arguably I wouldn't need any of the other ones.
Yeah.
But that's true no matter what with any of these sort of greedy schemes.
So, or what you could do, instead of putting 10 points there, at some point you just decide, well, now I only need 3 more points because you reached the error already.
Absolutely.
Trying to cut down on the total number of simulations because it seems here that kind of 3/4 are not actually contributing much anymore.
You're totally right, yeah.
Yeah, it looked like in the video on the left, like there was always like the biggest error there, but then no points appeared there until the end. There's a reason why.
Yeah, so this has to do with the fact that the Gaussian process, its errors are not based on the function values, it's just based on the distances between points and input space. So let's play this movie one more time. I mean, the density on the left side is roughly the same as on the right side, so it doesn't really have any reason to think that the errors on this side were higher than on this side. It's only once there's more training points here that it'll really start to think about what's over here more. So that's the reason why that happens. And of course you don't know where the actual error is. That's the point. You just have to make a good guess about what you think the error fluctuations could be and the places that they're likely to be high, but that's about it. Okay, let me just quickly, we're totally out of time, so let me just quickly tell you that you can actually use this method to estimate what the true error is, the true error level is, without actually looking at the true error level. So what I mean by that is, in orange here, I've plotted the true error, the maximum true error level in that video from before, as a function of the number of iterations. And I add 10 points at each iteration. So you see the error, as I add more points, it falls, and then it sort of flattens out. And then I can also take the maximum of what my estimated error is and plot that as a function of the iteration. And you see that that follows the true error, the true maximum error, pretty well. The point of this is just to say that in reality, I won't have access to the orange curve, because I don't know what relativity actually gives. I only have access to the blue curve. But I can use that to say, oh, well, this looks like it's sort of flattening out now. So that must mean that I've reached a pretty good level of error, and I shouldn't keep wastefully adding more numerical relativity simulations. So that's sort of an interesting idea, that you'll have some sort of sense of when you've done well enough. Again, it's all statistical, so you can't be 100% sure that you've done well enough, but statistically, you should
do. It would be highly interesting how this behaves if you add more dimensions to it. Because 1D is trivial. 2D is still easy, but of course, once you go to 40 or 18 or something, then
yep.
Is there a way you can test that in 18 dimensions without running numerical relativity simulations? You make a fake model about the waveforms and use that to populate things? In 18 dimensions?
That's how it's been done. I mean, some sort of ad hoc models. That's what we've always used for the 15 dimensions. But we've never really known what numerical relativity gave at all of those points.
Yeah, but I want to test your algorithm here.
You mean...
How it behaves in 18 dimensions instead
yes.
of in 2 dimensions.
Yeah, so that is like our next order of business immediately, just to go from 2 to 3.
18.
We probably won't do the extrinsic parameters, so we'll probably have 7, just the intrinsic parameters, the mass ratio and the spins.
Sure.
But yeah, that's totally the goal. I mean, that's the reason why we went for this, because you can do as many dimensions as you want. The limiting factor is the number of training points. And that's why MEEP is good, because it lowers the number of training points you would have to use compared to if you just naively make a regular grid.
So it seems you get some exponential convergence in the beginning, and that's pretty good.
Exponential convergence.
The error drops for every iteration by a certain
yes.
certain factor, and is that exponential convergence?
Yeah, because it's one log.
Yes. Otherwise, it would be a log log scale. Yes.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And my hope is that in 7 dimensions, you can keep that with a reasonable slope. And
yeah.
There are methods actually where you explicitly choose a basis to improve this, and I can't quite tell whether this is the case with you anymore. So I believe later on, I can't join the discussion. But we should definitely talk about and want to understand what is the equivalence of the basis in your language that you're choosing there. That would essentially increase the slope very much in high dimensions. In 2 or 3 dimensions, you probably wouldn't see any advantage.
Yeah. So certainly going to higher dimensions is something we want to do immediately. I mean, for now, we just want to show that this would even work in 2 dimensions. I think we have been able to show that. Let me just skip through all of this. The timing, let me just quickly say, it depends on the number of training points squared. So you want to minimize the number of training points. And for our model, if you don't parallelize anything, right? So there's 100 coefficients, you could calculate each one, you could interpolate each one independently on a different core or something like that. But supposing you don't do that, for us it's taking us about 100 milliseconds per waveform if we're able to mitigate some of the overhead in our Python code. If we're not able to mitigate that, it'll take about 5 seconds. But we think we can mitigate that overhead with maybe like a C implementation or something like that. But the main point of this is orders of magnitude below the months and weeks that it'll take for a numerical relativity simulation. And okay, again, the method is general. You could use a different reduced order model. You could use different kernels. You can modify MEEP. You could actually use this whole thing for some other totally separate non-gravitational wave problem you're interested in. You know, you have 3D simulations of supernovae, and you have 10 of those simulations, and you have spectra from those. Now you want to infer spectra for some other supernova. You could use something like this, maybe. All right, so we're able to make waveforms with uncertainties, we're able to evaluate them quickly, and we're able to suggest to numerical relativists what they should run next to make our model better. And we're going to run in 3+ dimensions as soon as possible, apply the method to maybe other reduced order models. We'll actually implement numerical relativity as a training set, and then once we've done that, maybe we can tell Lewis's group and other groups where to run their next numerical relativity simulations. And that's it.
Any questions? Or is it here?
You know, what's the distribution of all the 500?
Oh, okay.
Numerical simulations.
Oh, the current grid of numerical relativity?
Yeah, are they like, is it, you know, have people gone in some orderly fashion or something, which is maybe not the best for you, or they just did some random thing, and maybe that's,
they have concentrated on one or two axes, and then you're changing the mass ratio, and then maybe adding spin. So in the seven-dimensional space, it looks like kind of one or two directions have been explored, and three or four random points in there. I mean, it's a bit more dense than that, but there's definitely entire dimensions that are essentially uncovered, unexplored. Particularly if you add eccentricity or something. And the problem is also if you go to high mass ratios or high spins, then the numerical relativity simulations have a high error. That probably you want to take that into account as well. If your numerical relativity simulation has a high error, then no point in reducing the error there.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one of the things we can take into account with the wiggle room on each training point. If you run a simulation with a lower resolution than somebody else, we can take that all into account. With Gaussian errors, of course.
Question. I know there's been some work done on sort of breaking the mass, luminosity, distance, degeneracies by looking for spin precession for like really high spin systems. Does sampling over greater parameter spaces, did the work you're doing here help towards understanding how better to do that?
It should, because the ability to estimate the parameters will completely depend on how good your model is. And so if your model isn't good, then you won't be able to break degeneracies in the signals that you're getting. Does that make sense?
I was just wondering if you looked at spin precession.
Oh, I certainly haven't looked at precession here.
Okay.
Partly because the precessing models that we have, the approximants, take longer to produce. It's just a more complicated problem. So we're really just starting on the simplest thing we can and working our way up.
You go into a bit of detail about why you chose those particular covariance functions. Because it seems like, for example, the fact that you chose them to only depend on the distance between the points, that was very much reflective in the points that your greedy algorithm chose.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not obvious to me that that's the right choice.
Yes, I think that's completely right. There is no reason per se. Let me go back to the covariance function here. I don't think there's any reason per se to say this is the best choice. And this is just one of the two kernels that we played with. We played with this one and the Gaussian one. The Gaussian one is the one that's really commonly used by everyone. The problem with the Gaussian one is that it imposes very strong smoothness conditions on your interpolated functions, whereas this matern five halves kernel here does not have as strong smoothness conditions. That was why we chose it, just because it doesn't have those conditions. But there are other kernels that could be better, in particular kernels with compact support. That way they don't, you know, things way over here don't talk to things way over here. So that I think that could be like a whole nother study in and of itself, just to see how to optimize that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this is not the necessarily the best choice. And then obviously if you want your kernel not to only depend on the distances between points, then there's some other mathematics you have to do to make sure that things are well defined and not breaking.
Okay, I'll put Spencer again.